Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, presented by AT&T 5G. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Matt Doyle, Kalen Carr, back in the saddle on this Monday, December 12th. The World Cup still rolling along. MLS, obviously, in the offseason. We had a break. We had a breather. It is nice to be back with you guys. We're talking MLS, but we're doing so with heavy hearts. And I think that's where we'll start this show. Of course, so much to talk about in the transfer market as far as coach moving, everything going on in this league. But Grant Wall, he is the topic we start with. He's the man that we'll start with. His memory is what we'll start with. 49 years old, passed away Saturday doing what he loved, covering Argentina, Netherlands, in Qatar. One of many, many World Cups on the men's and women's sides he was a part of. I know, Dave, that you and Doyle and Bobby and Susanna and Jillian and Tom passed on your memories and honored Grant on Club and Country today, but we'd be remiss if we didn't do it here. We might not be here being paid to talk about soccer. We might not be here loving, promoting, working in this beautiful game if not for Grant. I always hear athletes talk about how they need an example to look toward. And as a Kansan who dreamed first of just getting Sports Illustrated from my dad on the day it arrived at his office, Grant was my example. I read every article he wrote. He wrote about college basketball, and that was probably my first true love. I grew up waiting for that magazine. I grew up waiting to see if there would be the Kansas Jayhawks on the cover. And if there were, Grant was going to be the guy that wrote that. Grant was a Kansan who devoted his time to his craft. He was a Kansan who devoted his professional ambition eventually to his true love, to soccer. He did that when I was imagining what it might be like to be a sports journalist. I wanted to be in soccer. I wanted to be Grant Wall. I remember meeting Grant Wall. I remember DMing with Grant Wall and just saying, hey, I'd love to have some advice. And it's so easy to brush those off. I know that I get those messages now, and it's a blessing to do so. But Grant gave me advice. He told me what he said, right. He said, whether it's free or someone's paying you, get some experience. Work your way in. He was a Kansan who made MLS and North American soccer come alive. I remember going to the bookstore and buying the Beckham experience. I remember reading that book. I remember thinking, my God, one, what a talent as a writer, as a reporter. These guys trusted him. And I think you could say that about just about everybody Grant covered in this game. He was a Kansan who treated me like a peer once I started to break into the industry. He was a Kansan I took a ton of cues from. I followed and covered the U.S. men's national team on the beat in 23 and 2014, 13 and 14, including at the World Cup. I mirrored, I followed, I watched, I listened to what Grant did, how he worked. That's what I wanted to emulate. He was a Kansan who tried to bring me on at SI. He's tried to do that with a lot of people. That effort changed my life. It's why I went to Brazil. I went to MLS and I said, hey, I have this opportunity. And they sent me to Brazil instead. And I always told Grant, hey, I wouldn't be here without you. He was a Kansan who just loved the game. He loved the people within it. He was a Kansan who was kind to people he didn't have to be kind to. He was a Kansan who was principled. The thing I admire most about Grant is he always challenged power. It didn't matter whether it was FIFA. It didn't matter if it was MLS. It was USSF. It didn't matter. He always was there to ask hard questions, to challenge power at every turn. He supported people, and we heard that from so many on Twitter. I'm not unique in that. I'm sure none of us are. Hey, I reached out to Grant. He gave me advice. He connected me with somebody. He said, hey, this is a job that you should apply to. He wanted to grow the game, and he made sure that tent was growing. He could also be prickly when challenged. Twitter brings out the best and the worst of all of us. Sometimes he had an ego. I'd say he earned that one over years and years of producing some of the best soccer journalism this country's ever seen. He led the way for the rest of us. He was complex. He was human. He unabashedly and passionately loved his wife, his family, his dogs, good food, collecting match shorts, journalism. He led the way, and he will be missed greatly. I'm still in shock. I don't know what to say other than he is the example that I base so much of my career around, and that I know that it's unlikely I would have this career if it was not for all the work that Grant did before anybody else was doing it. Grant Wall, 49. a legacy that can never be taken away. Any thoughts, guys? Anything to add before we do what, as you said so aptly, Dave, on Club and Country today, we do what Grant would have wanted all of us to do, which is talk about soccer, this game that we love?
Yeah, just echoing what you said, which is I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. And we didn't have the closest personal relationship, but I grew up the same way, consuming soccer through him and believing that the game could grow and that there was roles in it because he had created one. And so was the same way that I came into a lot of the sport. And I think you see it celebrated across the sports world after his passing, of NBA players and writers and politicians and writers from around the world. Everyone had a connection to him because he had had such a legacy and had grown so much. And that was growing the sport in this country. So I always appreciate that from him. And it was one of those moments where we weren't introduced because we both at some point sort of knew each other. And my first interaction with him was like, oh, I belong here, sort of. Right. And that's was the statue he had. And as many people have said, he was very kind about that. So I always really appreciated that. And it's always been one of those memories that I have. I can remember being at a media mixer at MLS Cup and just we fell into a conversation and had that acknowledgement of we both know each other, but weren't introduced. And it was like, oh, wow, Grant Wall has heard some of the work I've done and knows who I am. And that's a really special moment. I think, as you've seen online, that's a special moment for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about like the sense of belong here or kind of welcoming in part, and so much of what we've seen of online in the past few days has been kind of echoing that. And I remember when I first finished playing and I MLS sent me around to not to Brazil, maybe that would have been nice, but I was going around following the U.S. men's national team at the Gold Cup. And I was going into some of the like press boxes, which I'd never been in a press box before. And I was like, I don't know if I belong here. Grant was there and was always welcoming. And I think even like at another level, like in a way it felt like, you know, with where he was writing at Sports Illustrated and all these places, it was almost like he helped like soccer belong here.
Yes.
You know, and to make it feel like it should be, that was kind of, you know, as North American soccer players or fans or media, you're always just kind of like, based on our history, you're always sort of wondering where is your place in the world? Like, yeah. And maybe feeling like, oh, I don't really have a place, or we're holding on. Like, you know, we're trying to build this league. We're trying to build this sport. And I feel like Grant just always had such a vision for that and helped everybody kind of feel like, even through him, that there was a place for soccer in this country. And, you know, even down to like, I was reflecting back and I went to go, even like as a storyteller, going to try to tell North American soccer stories. I remember going down to DC to do a movement episode, and Pablo Maurer was nice enough to join in, because I was like, hey, I can't come to DC and not talk to you. And you know, he's had some, you know, he shared his feelings about Grant and their relationship. But it was really funny. We were talking to Lincoln Phillips, the legendary Howard coach and ex-pro, and we were going through a bunch of old kind of materials around it, and we found a Grant Wall research paper from, I think it was college?
Yeah, from Princeton.
From Princeton, yeah. It was the, it's right here. It's one of his old term papers. And it was a handwritten note from Grant to Lincoln Phillips about, you know, this story that he'd written. And it was just kind of one of those things where for me, I was like, wow, like this guy had such vision for the sport. I think the stories he told, the volume of them, where it's almost like you couldn't find a soccer story that he hadn't been across or helped try and raise. And so I think the idea that that legacy is so huge and one that I think inspired so many people, myself personally, even without knowing him. And so, yeah, those are, I agree. It doesn't quite feel real. It hasn't really sunk in yet, but yeah, that legacy is just huge.
I think if you, to that point, anybody who writes about, who thinks, who researches, who just wants to remember the stories, the history, where we've been with the sport in the U.S., you can't do it without Grant's work.
Yeah.
You know, for decades and decades, it's just, you can't do it. You can't write our history. You can't go back and access those memories and somebody had to be there. And to Grant's credit, you know, we're talking about the stories he wrote for SI. He could have said, I'm going to be the biggest magazine writer in the country on college basketball and the NBA and all these sports that were established and had preeminence and, you know, had a career path that was carved out. And I always respected Grant for saying, you know what? I know what my passion is. I know what I love. We always beg for sort of mainstream media. Hey, editors at this national paper, you know, ESPN producers, like, make soccer and make American soccer and the breadth of stories within American soccer, make them matter. Make them appear in your pages. Make them appear on the front page. Put them in Sports Center. And it doesn't always happen. And I think, you know, Grant sacrificed in some ways a professional pathway to do what he loved, to grow the game that he loved, and to demand that a place like Sports Illustrated in that time, which was the sort of top, it was magazine journalism, it was the smart, deep, well-reported, best reporters, best columnists, it was the spot. He said, no, this is what I'm going to do, and you're going to make room for me to do it. And that takes bravery. Like, it takes bravery. He went out on a limb, and I always will appreciate that.
Yeah, and it speaks to who he was. The fact that everything from covering the U.S. men's national team and the women's national team, and it needs to be said, Grant was the first prominent sports writer to, I think, cover both of those teams equally, to give equal time to both men's and women's side of the game. But to that, to covering college soccer, or at least having the background to and the interest to do what Kalen was describing even 30 years ago when he was in college himself, to traveling to the hinterlands of, you know, Eastern Europe to do stories there, to all around CONCACAF. He was the type of person who produced work that is unable to be imitated in the breadth and the ability to know people everywhere and speak on it and write on it intelligently. That is the primary legacy I think that everyone will have with Grant as a journalist, that and the Beckham experiment, of course. As someone whose mind and entire life has been completely corrupted by the pursuit of good content, what I have to admit, after Club and Country Today the other day, Bobby brought up Grant's annual ambition rankings that he does for MLS teams. And I remember when he first produced those, I was so mad because I didn't think of doing it first. And we are never going to replace Grant. There will never be another Grant. I am desperate for someone to pick up the torch and do the annual ambition rankings. We can't really do it at MLSsoccer.com, right? We don't cover that part of the league in that way. But whether it's the guys at The Athletic or you know, Jeff Carlisle at ESPN, or the guys at Soccer America, or, you know, maybe Brian Strauss at SI, who, you know, if you're listening to this, Brian, we know that you knew Grant better than anyone. We're all thinking of you, man. But one of Grant's legacies should be that. I mean, that's a tentpole column every single year. We all look forward to it. I know that GMs and owners across the league look forward to it or not, in varying degrees. It's a fitting tribute. It's a fitting legacy for Grant, for something so freaking great that he created, to not end with his passing. I hope somebody's able to grab that mantle and push it forward, because it is annually, it is one of the best columns in U.S. and Canadian soccer every single year.
I think you can look to what you just said about, hey, all these people that could potentially do that work, that are in a position to do that work. That is one of Grant's primary legacies, because around the time of the Beckham experiment, you know, around the time I was thinking, hey, I might want to be a soccer journalist in this country, you would go read Due Nord, or you would go through all the, clicking through all the links, just searching through Google, trying to find this content. And those jobs weren't there. You know, those opportunities weren't there. It was Grant and a lot of people trying to bootstrap and find a way up. And I think the example he led has been part of why you see so much growth on the media side of this game. I mean, I'll also mention, it's not necessarily on like the red blood content side, but he covered institutions within the game better than anybody in North America, maybe better than anybody in the world.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, whether it be FIFA or as I said, USF, MLS leagues, the organizations that govern this game, the decisions that are made on that front, the equity that he was always sort of driving for, that will be greatly, greatly missed. And I hope that void can be filled as well. I think I speak for everyone who loves soccer in this country. And for all of us, I just say thank you, Grant Wall. The game in the United States wouldn't be where it is today without you. We probably wouldn't be here today without Grant and the yeoman's work he did to legitimize and grow the media side of all of this. Grant, may your legacy live on every day through all of us who share your lifelong mission. Soccer will always be the beautiful game, and you helped us understand and appreciate that beauty and the work it takes to fashion it in our own reflection. And I think that's an important part of this too. Grant was a supporter of soccer worldwide, but he in particular was a supporter of soccer in the U.S. And making this a game that we could all be proud of. And I think we're well on the way to that. Rest in peace, Grant Wall, a soccer pioneer. Joe Radicevich hit us up and he said, you guys asked for memorable articles from Grant Wall. The first one Joe remembers was his 98 profile of the next big American soccer player, Jamar Beasley. Beasley, his little brother, DeMarcus, was it. So he thinks about that article regularly. Grant was 24 when he wrote that, and Joe was 14 when he read it. He was one of the few Americans writing about soccer back then. So Joe says he's been on my guide to the soccer world for 24 years and 7 World Cups. That doesn't include, I don't believe, all the Women's World Cups Grant covered as well, which he would put on equal stature, obviously. Joe says he'll miss him. He's writing his other projects every World Cup. Last month, I commented on his newsletter site how much I love his magazine-style articles. He commented back that he never wanted to stop writing them. I'm glad I could tell him how much I appreciated what he did. I wish he could have done more, but what he did is plenty. Any articles, I'm with you on the ambition rankings. Like, I remember when that published every single year, we'd be in the office at MLS Soccer and we'd be rubbing our hands together. Like, all right, what do we got here? Who, you know, what shots did Grant take? Rightfully so.
So I'm going to say the same thing I said on Club and Country today, which is that Grant wrote a lot of – he wrote a lot for more than 25 years professionally. Obviously, he was writing in college as well. And more than any one article, what I will remember is that in the final days of his life, he was producing features, and then he would produce, you know, game – ratings and analysis. And, you know, the day before he died, he produced a commentary on the abuses of migrant workers in Qatar, which goes back to what you said, Weeby, about how he did a better job covering institutions than any of us, maybe any of us in the world. And even on the day he died, he wrote a reaction to the Brazil-Croatia game. It's hard to write that much. It's hard to grind for years and years and years, but it was clearly in his blood, and I admire the hell out of that.
I mean, the Beckham experiment was formative to me, and I think it was formative for North American soccer overall. Just the idea that you could write a book about MLS and soccer in this country, the idea that the curtain could be peeled back like that, and others have done it since. And when you have this breadth of people covering the game and the connections they have, that happens more and more. But that will forever be a very formative thing for me. It was right as I was sort of in journalism school thinking, God, could I do this? Could I even be a sports journalist? And if I can, what are the odds I can do it in soccer, which is what I love most of all and what I'm desperate to be a part of? Reading that book was, it was formative, man. And I remember after I read it, I went to Amazon and I just bought used copies of every soccer book I could find and spent like the next 6 months just running through them. It was a starting point. I wouldn't say it lit the fire, but it was the gasoline that got dumped on the fire. And, you know, it was the story of Beckham and Landon and all the, and Bruce and these guys. But it was more so it was the story of Alan Gordon and the idea that there were all these stories within our soccer sphere that were going untold, that were unknown, that were compelling, that were human. That needed to be unearthed, and Grant was as he was better than anybody at finding those and giving them the space, the oxygen, the words that they needed, and people trusted him with their stories. And I think there's no better compliment to a journalist than that. People trusted Grant Wall to tell their stories, and you know, I think that really does say it all. I'll also say the you know, Kansas wins the 08 national title was also a really like that story too, from a personal perspective. But and that he was a Kansan, he was a Chiefs fan, he was, you know, he's from my neck of woods. That was all part of it for me, of like, oh my God, this guy from where I'm from, he's doing it, you know, like. And I had no illusions that I could do it like Grant, but I thought, man, maybe I can just hang out in his shadow for a little bit and climb the stairs when nobody's looking. So any final thoughts before we do what we normally do and I guess cover some Gio Reyna drama, some news from MLS we haven't hit? All right, let's call it good. If you have thoughts on Grant, his legacy, what he meant to you, you know we'd love to hear him. ExtraTime@MLSsoccer.com. You can tweet at us on Twitter as always. Let's do it. Let's get into it. Yeah, Gio Reyna. So, yeah, Gio Reyna. What is going on, Doyle? What? Well, I just saw Gio just put out an Instagram post, and he says he had hoped not to comment on matters at the World Cup. It's his belief that things happen in a team setting ought to remain private. That being said, statements have been made that reflect on his professionalism and character, so he has to make a brief statement. He basically said that before the World Cup, Greg Berhalter told him his role would be very limited. Gio says he was devastated. As someone who plays with pride and passion, soccer is his life, etc. He believes in himself. He fully expected and desperately wanted to make a contribution as they tried to make a statement. He's also an emotional person. He let that get the best of him. And he was disappointed and he apologized. I don't think I have to read the whole thing. You can go to his Instagram and read
it. Oh, I don't know. I think the last paragraph. Oh. The last paragraph and a half. I apologize to my teammates and coach for this, and I was told I was forgiven. Thereafter, I shook off my disappointment and gave everything I had on and off the field. I am disappointed that there is continuing coverage of this matter, as well as some highly fictionalized versions of events, and extremely surprised that anyone on the U.S. men's team staff would contribute to it. Coach Berhalter has always said that issues that arise with the team will stay in-house so we can focus on team unity and progress. I love my team. I love representing my country, and I am focusing now only on improving and growing as a soccer player and a person. I hope that going forward, each person involved in U.S. soccer focuses only on what is in the best interest of the men's national team so we can enjoy great success at the World Cup.
So I skimmed. I got much more out of the first couple paragraphs and then just skimmed through the last part of this.
I'm just mad that Doyle beat me. I thought Instagram was my beat. I'm mad that he beat me.
I will also tell you that Christian Pulisic has stopped liking Gio's posts on Instagram.
Oh, this is wow.
I do have reports.
I didn't do that one myself. That was I can't say where that one came from. But anyway,
it does seem like Matt Turner and Joe Scally have liked that post.
Okay.
By Gio Reyna, as well as some players who are not in the World Cup pool. So that's all I have as of now.
Okay. Well, we will, Kaylin, can we put the responsibility on you to monitor the gram?
I'll be following the likes all.
And report back on. You probably also should dig through the follows. Cross-reference follows. I don't know if you could do that for us. I mean, the background here is obvious. Like Gio Reyna at the World Cup, didn't get the playing time he wanted. There was the issue with the quote unquote, is he injured? Is he not injured? People were screaming for him to play more. He wasn't playing more, didn't really play more until the second half of the Netherlands game. But then the thing is that Greg went to a conference, a leadership conference, correct? Mm-hmm. And it was off the record. You know, when you speak in, even in sort of a closed door setting, oftentimes those things have a way of going on the record.
The election of the Pope. Everything's on the record.
Have a way. People have a way. And I guess there's a newsletter of some sort. Somebody was there. I don't think it was the newsletter of the actual conference. This is all very confusing. It'd be much
whoever
easier.
Was there knew exactly. If you go and read the piece, it is literally ends at the Gio Reyna stuff. Like that person knew exactly what was newsworthy and did not put in any of the excess.
We won't do you the dishonor of reading the entire Greg Berhalter quote as we've just done with Gio Reyna's Instagram post, but basically it was that there was a guy at the World Cup that was an issue, wasn't training at the level that was expected. There was an issue between myself and him, the staff and him, then his teammates and him. There was a moment there where we thought we might have had to send him home. In the end, we didn't do that. There was reporting that there was a vote among the players and it was 13-12. That report per Taylor Twellman is erroneous and false, which it's crazy to think that it would not be erroneous and false, but it is erroneous and false. Did Greg talk to his staff? That seems to be clear that did happen. They discussed what they should do about this. in the end, Gio was the guy that was reported as being this player, which Gio has, I guess, confirmed.
Yeah, he
basically
just got through it.
Yeah, like it. Yeah. Confirmed on Instagram. And that he apologized to the team. Some of his teammates basically had some words for him afterwards, said, hey, this is what we expect going forward. He did that and then played. And here we are, messy, messy, messy. People wanted Greg to be like, what was going on? What's going on with Gio? Tell us the truth during the World Cup. All I can say is thank God this didn't come out in the World Cup, because this is a circus, an absolute circus. We don't know all the facts. I'll say that for sure. You know, Instagram reporting and, you know, email newsletters aside,
you're also in a space where you're talking about opinions.
Yes.
I don't know that facts are ever going to be the reason any of this happened. And so that's part of what makes it hard as well. Listen, on Gio's statement, I get a decent amount of it, right? We have had players in this World Cup cycle who have been suspended from the team, left out of the team. And it has been pretty consistent from the top down at US Soccer that internal things stay internal. So I can understand Gio's issue and complaint that it got put out there. It also feels like in a World Cup, one of the things I've said over the last few weeks, and we keep seeing it, is a World Cup, maybe you can maybe speak to it more from being there in 2014. It is the tightest a group can ever be, because there is no access to anyone in the camp. They are so closed off. And so this was probably going to come out no matter what at this point, I think, is the other side of things, where thank God it didn't come out during the World Cup. Well, the players are all staying together, being together, the staff as well.
Just want to clear up, Paul and Sam said they had it. Paul and Sam said they were publishing today whether or not Berhalter had, you know, put his foot in it, in my opinion, and said what he said at that conference. But anyway, please continue.
No, so that's all I would say in terms of the way this has gone down now, is I can understand the frustration on the player side and feeling let down that this is now how you're operating. On the flip side, as Doyle said, it's out there. And it was clear, I think, for the people internally that it was going to be out there.
What do you think as a player, Kalen?
It does matter how it comes out, I think, because I agree it was going to come out no matter what. This is just such a huge storyline. It was like everybody was talking about this the entire World Cup, right? Or the World Cup's still going on, but the our time in it. But I do think it does matter that it comes out, and it is disappointing that it would come out from Berhalter himself, essentially. And I'm sure he'd be disappointed too that it came out this way, but it was a conference from what I understand. So anytime you speak at a conference, there's a risk, right? So that just seems like, I don't know. Yeah, it's that part does matter. But the thing is, from the player perspective of things, I mean, nothing really would shock me as far as really anything goes. I've seen some wild stuff happen in locker rooms or around the team, or guys being pushed out the team or training on the side. I mean, we hear about this happen across leagues, really anywhere. It is interesting to me, some of the reporting, and the concerning part to me is like, it takes, from my perspective, it takes a lot for your own teammates to feel like to kind of like not be on your side, I would say. From my experience, like, I've seen guys do some wild stuff and still you're like, hey, I'm with you, we got your back, come on, you have go have a talk. Sounds like some of those conversations were happening. So I think the fact that it wasn't just like a staff, from what it sounds like, it wasn't just like a staff versus Gio or Greg versus Gio one-on-one like disagreement, that it kind of like went beyond that, that's where it's kind of like, okay, that changes the way I view things a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's disappointing. I understand the feeling of being like, well, not to this scale, of course, but anytime you find out that your role is not going to be what you think, you know, I could see how you're out of a training, you're want to play in the World Cup, and you're like, and suddenly you're walking around a training ground scrimmage and you're thinking, this is the best I have, or this is likely my role here, and not being okay with that. But ultimately, you have to keep your mind on like the bigger goal at hand, right? And he did play a role and came in halftime. And if it was just that, like, maybe it changes things, and maybe that extra week of fitness or whatever it is that you missed, those training sessions or that scrimmage or whatever, like, that matters a lot. And it matters as well to the rest of your team, as far as the overall preparation or the usefulness of the exercise. So, yeah, it's disappointing. He said it as much. He's disappointed that there's continued coverage. I'm not surprised that there's continued coverage.
Like, he's disappointed in you.
He's disappointed in the way it came out. That's the one part I do get, is he felt like we squashed it, but that's part of the way things go. Like, you tried to hold it together in the team, thought they did a good job of holding it throughout the tournament. But for, I think the way it comes out does matter in this case. And then begs the question, kind of like, how do these relationships, whether it's between the staff and, you know, there's question marks is what's the future of that, but even just within the team, just within the guys, like within that group, how are those relationships and how do those things move forward from here?
That's the big question for me. Because all this stuff is the past, but the past is going to inform the future, and you're working toward 26, and Gio Reyna is an immensely talented player who you would expect, based on his talent level and the trajectory of his career, to be a very large part of this team moving forward, Doyle, but it seems like he has a deficit, like a culture deficit to work off with his teammates. It seems like, look, and again, we don't know the facts. We don't know how those guys feel.
Yeah.
Well, it sounded like they had kind of squashed it, at least to some degree, but now it's like coming out. And so all those
it's unsquashed again, I guess.
Although in theory, if he's following Claudio's path, 2030 is his peak World Cup, right? Because didn't Claudio just make 94, but then 02 was his peak?
He was going to be on the 94 team, but he got injured before the World Cup. Yeah, so okay. he didn't make that.
Okay,
team.
So second World Cup, so 26 could be the one for Gio.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like, there's no question of the kid's talent. He's had issues off the field throughout his youth career. He, you know, nobody really reported on it because he was literally a child at the time, but he broke curfew at the U-17 World Cup a couple of years ago with the U.S. And that type of off-field stuff has not been unusual for him in his career. And I don't follow Dortmund all that closely, but people who do, including journalists over there. Now, there are multiple differing accounts of this. Some journalists, Derek Ray, who I hold in very high esteem, has said, I've never heard anything but, you know, good things about Gio Reyna's professionalism with Dortmund. Other journalists have said, oh, this kind of fits in with what we've seen from him in terms of his sort of poutiness and petulance around Dortmund this year. I think it's pretty clear that the kid needs to take this moment to heart, whether he's happy with how it came out or the fact that it did come out. He needs to take this moment to heart and figure out how to be a little bit better of a teammate, because that, you know, there's going to be a lot of commentary on this, but the one thing that seems inarguable is that on the eve of the World Cup, he let his teammates down, and they were able to move past it, right? And they got out of the group. I thought they played really, really well for the most part. Once Gio was close enough to fit to play a role, which came in that Netherlands game, he got out in the field for the second half. I thought he was arguably our best attacking player. Hopefully that is what can be the catalyst for the next cycle. And that underpinning it is him remembering that it needs to be at that level in terms of production, whether it's on or off the field, because that's the job. You have to, it's not all about you. You have to be a good teammate too. And the good thing is that guys like Pulisic and Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie, and remember, Weston had his own issues with being a professional during qualifying, right? But he bounced back and he played, I thought, great at this World Cup, playing through an injury. Like, these guys will be around, and hopefully they will be able to reintegrate him culturally.
Sorry, Darren, we're not laughing at you. We got a whole thing going on in the chat right now.
Chat was good. I wish we could publish that, but I'm glad that we would never do so.
So I agree with Doyle. And listen, where we're at right now is Giordano needs to get healthy, needs to play every day. Most of what he needs to do has to happen at the club level anyway. And we're in that phase around the World Cup, especially with the team that we believe will automatically qualify for 2026, where his job and the focus now has to happen at the club level. That's the Gio Reyna side. I think you were asking about then the other side, which is Greg Berhalter now has said this publicly, technically not about Gio Reyna because he never said his name. And where does he connect?
Yeah, but if I was like, look, there's a guy that's kind of like ruining the chemistry on the show. He wears a Sounders beanie to meetings. Like, nobody would be like, oh, who is that? Is that producing Anders or somebody else? And I'd be like, oh, it's freaking
I will say at a minimum, I don't believe this will have an effect on whether or not Greg Berhalter will be coach of this team. It's one player. There's clearly connection and buy-in from across this club or from across the talent pool in him as a leader. I have said many times, I don't totally believe in having someone coach a second cycle. We could talk about that, but I don't believe this specific situation will be the reason he will or will not return or be brought back as the coach.
Let's talk about that. I will also say, I jokingly, and I'm one of many, I'm sure, on Twitter said, hey, we're a real footballing nation now. Like, you know, France hasn't exactly been like a den of friends as a national team for generations here. You know, like Belgium, we're turning on each other at the World Cup. Like, this is not out of the norm for locker rooms, for professional
athletes.
It's just
so messed
up. For people, let alone just professional athletes. Like, think of your friend groups.
I just can't get over the fact that England have gone out with, like, in a very tragic way, but with, like, zero drama. Like, even English fans are like, wow, we played really well. Some of them are Southgate out, but it's very stable from England. And here we are.
They actually did.
In fairness, Doyle, they had a player leave.
Yeah, they sent a guy
and no
home.
One knows why. So
this is just not – it's not that crazy. And, you know, maybe this is what happens when you get players at a certain level.
Maybe this is just an orchestrated thing to grow the game.
I mean –
to there generate the next big Netflix special behind the scenes about it.
There we go.
A team to do it here.
If F1 can do it, certainly the USMNT can do it. Yeah, how about Greg Berhalter and his future? There's reporting, obviously, that he is set for USMNT contract talks. What that means is not entirely clear. I mean, I would think that they would be talking to him, certainly. They would be like, it'd be dereliction of duty if they weren't trying to do that, given the accomplishments that he has and the World Cup that the U.S. had and the performances therein.
I don't know that I agree with that, Weeby.
Just to have the talk. I'm saying the talk of like, do you want to come back? If you did, what would it take? You have to have a conversation.
I don't know that I agree with that. I think that if you have leadership in Ernie Stewart and Brian McBride who are long-term planning, you should have had an idea of whether or not he was your coach going into the World Cup. And you should be making that decision first before you talk to him.
Well, you probably would, right? That's why you talk to him.
If you know you're
not going to bring him back, then you wouldn't go talk to him.
So,
it takes two to tango. So you got to go talk to Greg and make sure that his situation matches up with your situation.
Well, no, I would say you need to decide if you want him to come back first. And I don't know that that's the right call. So I don't know that there's 100% that you have a conversation. That's what I'm saying.
I think that'd be crazy, but
okay.
Just in terms of just like discussing with a person and leader within your organization what the future looks like, the connection there is clear. You'd at least have to say, what are you looking to do? Do you want to coach this national team? If so, and you want him to come back, then you have the opening of that conversation. If he says, no, I want to go coach in Europe, well, that's part of contract talks as well, and they've been so broadly defined that I think that would still fall under it. You know, these are long-term co-workers. These are long-term planners together of the program. I'm sure they've discussed what 22 to 26 looks like, but now this is the nitty-gritty of whether or not you'll lead it. We've talked about this. We don't know if he'll be back. I still tend to think that if Greg gets an offer in Europe at a situation that would make sense for him at a club team, he will go ahead and take that offer. And maybe that's part of this as well, as USMNT saying, okay, well, what's your timeline here? Like, if you don't do that, do you want to come back? I don't know. Doyle, how do you read the situation?
I think if he gets an offer in Europe, he will take it. I don't have any inside information on that, but we've all pretty consistently felt that way, right? Like Berhalter is very detailed and system oriented, and that is more the club game than the international game. What I will say is that I really loved the way the U.S. played in this World Cup. I think this is the first World Cup I watched us play, and we had more in common with the big teams, the teams that can and almost, not even almost, the teams that always do win the World Cup. And maybe Morocco will break that streak this year. We can keep our fingers crossed, because that'd be a hell of a lot of fun. But the U.S. played like one of them. It wasn't complete, right? We struggled to create chances. I think that was much more due to execution than scheme. But we tilted the field. We had the ball in good spots. We were really, really good defensively in a way where we prevented basically easy runouts. I don't care whether it's Berhalter or his successor. What's important to me is that we keep that tactical approach and build onto it, rather than doing what we have had a habit of doing, which is just scraping everything off the plate and starting all over again. So whether it's Berhalter or whether it's Carlo Ancelotti, whether it's Gareth Southgate, I don't freaking care. I just care that we keep playing the way we played over this past month, because I firmly believe that the way we played is the combined with the talent that we have, including Gio Reyna, continuing to improve and hopefully being healthy all at the same time for once. That is the path into the top 10, and maybe eventually before I die, to actually winning the World Cup. So that is it. But I don't care if Greg is back. I don't care who the next coach is. I just want that continuity of scheme and structure and approach to playing the game.
We have a statement here from Anders that I would like to read at this time. Quote, "I'm extremely disappointed that things I said in a private production meeting were taken out of context." So do we need to take a vote on Anders' status on the team going forward? Or do you think I could probably just, you know, Anders, if you apologize following this show, we would love to have you stay on as our producer. Okay. We'll see what happens with
we don't have any other options right now.
We don't. There's no backups here, so I really hope that you either do so or just ignore us. All right, let's talk MLS. Wilfred Nancé officially to the Columbus Crew. Somebody on this show, all seeing eye, predicted that back in October. This is a very, very good hire, Dave.
You?
It was me. I said literally the day after Caleb Porter was relieved of his duties, that if I was the Columbus Crew, I would try to hire Wilfred Nancé.
Interesting.
But I'll do all the back padding on my own. I won't expect you to do that for me. Great hire. What do you think?
Yeah, awesome hire. I think I voted for him as coach of the year last year. He did a lot with a little. We've talked about multiple times what he did 2 years ago with the team being quarantined in the U.S. and still playing at a high level. So he has shown that he can connect with players. He's shown that he can build players up. Look at the exit of Sales going on right now and continue to win at the same time. Clear identity, clear philosophy of how he wants the game played. And I do believe there's a lot of pieces in Columbus that fit into that. So this, if I am right, could be a win now and build for the future move for Columbus. They won the MLS Next Pro Championship because they're investing more at the lower levels to build the club out. He's the type of coach who helps that, but also coached the second best team in the Eastern Conference without having big name players and DPs. And so this just feels like a match made in heaven. And I don't even know what to say about Montreal at this point. This guy's lived in your city for 16 years, came through as an amateur coach, youth ranks to the pro scene, and within 2 years decided he could not succeed at your club and had to leave, and then made that move inside the league.
Yeah, that's wild. And that's the thing we've been talking about is, I think on the show, Weeby, to your point, sometimes we're saying we should go after more proven success within the league, right? We just saw Garth Lagerwey go to Atlanta, right? Going after ambitious hires within the league that you know make sense and you know are working. And it was very clear from Nancé the way he was playing, what he was able to do and the way he was able to get the most out of this roster. And just look at all the outbound transfers even that are going on. But some of those, it feels like this one might be might hurt the most for Montreal, because at least if you kept him, then you can suddenly begin that process again of identifying players, bringing through young talent through the academy, developing them, finding the right balance, team chemistry, the ideas, the philosophy. And now it's like you lost that too. I agree. I think it's a perfect fit for Columbus. And when you look at that roster, I mean, even in the best moments of this team, like the way they're able to keep possession of the ball, the way they're able to move it, sometimes it didn't have that kind of cutting edge, but you see all the talent is there within this roster, which was why it was so disappointing to see them not make the playoffs on the final day. So I think for Anansi to come in, I mean, it's a dream situation for him to be able to implement. It doesn't have to go out and do a full rebuild the way he was actually having to look at it at Montreal. And he instead gets kind of like a plug and play where he just takes his system, which will take some time, I'm sure, to fill in. But it seems like a perfect fit.
Here's a quote from Gabriel Gervais, who's the CEO of CF Montreal. "Despite the club's efforts to have Wolfer continue our project, we were forced to accept his decision to leave the organization. We want people who want to be with us, and Wilfred has chosen a different path."
Just to throw out there, what, four players getting sold, Wanyama leaving, your coach leaving. I don't know how many people want to be there. That doesn't mean that they're not doing good work from a competitive side, but there's not a ton of example of that.
So two things I'll point out is, like, nobody really knew who Wilfred Nancy was before he took that job, right? So there are really good coaches just, you know, kicking around, hopefully getting the right shot. It happened to Jim Curtin 8 years ago now. It happened to Nancy a couple of years ago. Maybe they have, I think, Weeby's mentioned Jan Dame as a potential here.
Yeah, or, and another guy who spent a bunch of time in their academy setup. Right. And obviously was at Cincinnati, has been with the Galaxy. But he would seem to fit with the, like, hey, French speaking, understands our youth setup, understands the talent that we need to bring through. He would fit a mold.
Yeah, and the one who won't fit a mold, but who I keep thinking of, is Alessandro Nesta, who, of course, played a couple years at the end of his career for Montreal about a decade ago. And who has had a couple of jobs in Italy that have gone mostly okay, but also things in bottom of Serie A and Serie B, coaches don't stick around a while. After he left his most recent job, which was, I believe, the middle of 2021, he gave an interview where he said, "I want to come back to MLS because in MLS, they give you a project and they let you stick with that project and they let you build something."
Is that is that true about Montreal?
I mean, it would have been with Nancy, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think the project is going to stay
Henri
the same.
Henri chose
right?
to lose.
It, to leave.
Henri did. Yeah.
My bad. Just Belgium, you know, there's so much going on.
No, but I mean, it doesn't seem like they've had managers for a long time, right?
They haven't.
It's been a lot of turnover over the years. And I think that would be...
I would just say, so before Henri, it was Wilmer Cabrera, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything about the Wilmer Cabrera appointment was short-term thinking. And that's the way the club, from a roster point of view and coaching point of view, was operating. They have clearly shifted, right? They've shifted on the player side totally. It's not just 32-year-old Argentines and 35-year-old Italians. Like, there's long-term planning for the roster side. And it feels safe to assume that there's that trust with the coaching side as well. So I do think you have to acknowledge that in the way they've shifted that, yeah, they've had a ton of coaches. Part of that, though, is the volatility of the workspace.
Yeah, I mean, definitely when you think of Henri and COVID and this team living in Florida and all that. But yeah, it just felt like it was set up for more with Nancy as far as understanding that culture and club and being able to really kind of build from the future. So I don't know. It stands out to me as a really big loss for them.
Yeah, it is. Their project, I will say, stays. Olivier Renard has done a good job. They were always going to be a team that was trying to find undervalued assets in MLS, trade for them to promote academy players.
I think now are
correct. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. They've found that path.
Yeah.
But it seemed like Nance was just kind of like, yeah, I mean, I've kind of, he proved it on that path, right? Like, they sold Kone for a club record fee, which Tom Bogert's reporting is around $8 to $10 million. That's crazy. Like, that is a huge number for a guy that basically just broke in as a pro. Georgie got sold for $6 million. They just sold Alistair Johnson for $3.5 million after trading for him from Nashville. Like, Waterman could be sold. You know, Kamal Miller could be sold. If Toy has a good season, he could be sold. It seemed like Wilfred Nancy was just saying, hey, I want to go to a place where, like, the onus is on winning and also this other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, and you know, he talked about walking in, the facilities, the players. They'll have Kucho, they'll have Zelrayan, Nagby's in the team. You know, and I love the fact that ambitious teams within an MLS are looking around saying, like, what's it going to take to get that guy? Mm-hmm. Like, it happens with players. Why shouldn't it happen with coaches? Why shouldn't the crew look around and be like, yo, you know, Joey Saputo in Montreal, what we got to give you?
Well, and also, I think Doyle mentioned this when we talked about Garth, but there's no salary cap off the field. You want to be competitive in MLS. There are ways to be competitive that are not controlled, right? And it's building out your scouting department and building out your facilities physically and supporting more academy setups. And one of them is getting the most competitive coaches and doing that. I think for Columbus, there is potentially a cap on their market. Like, they are not New York or LA. This is a space that they can be in and be really strong in. And so I thought it was the right acknowledgement. I'm 2 years in on being snake bitten on preseason Columbus picks. So I'm waiting a little bit to sort of anoint them. 2 years ago, I said they were the best returning MLS Cup roster and they didn't make the playoffs. This year I had them back in the playoffs and they didn't do it again. So I'm just waiting a little bit there. I'm excited,
not to be morbid, but I want to bring it back to Grant for a minute, because this off season is the first time that we've seen clubs being ambitious in this way, whether it's, I don't want to say poaching, but like getting a top executive from another club, getting a top coach from, like, I voted for Wilfred Nancy for coach of the year. Same. So did Jim Curtin, who won coach of the year. He said that Wilfred Nancy deserved it. I would have loved to see how Grant would cover this in the ambition rankings. And I'll put out a plea yet again to whether it's Strauss or Sam and Paul or Jeff Carlisle. Keep those going, because it's a great way to cover MLS. It is part of Grant's legacy, and it's man, 2023 version is going to absolutely bang given what we've seen over the past few weeks.
Doyle, I'm going to ask for yours in the group chat.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we could start a Patreon to the Discord.
Nothing's off the record. All right, even people paying, they'll spread that. It becomes free point. Quite quickly if you put it in a public space. Kone to Watford, club record fee. I mentioned that. Celtic sign Alistair Johnston. Maybe others going too. Again, there are reports in Turkey that Joel Waterman is in demand, and maybe Kamal Miller. I don't think Montreal are hosed, to use a Canadian term here. They still have some talent. But certainly the core of the club is being sold. Now, that also means there's a ton of allocation money coming in, as well as just money that can fund, you know, DP-related transfers or, you know, as someone here said, sort of like facility upgrades. But it is going to be very interesting to see how Montreal are able to deal with and absorb these departures and then use the assets that come with them and how they approach this transfer window in the next year or so. I mean, look, if you're looking around the league, you got to expect Renard's going to be calling you. If you got a guy who's talented, who's young, who hasn't been playing a ton, there might be some big blockbusters from Montreal, because that game has to be spent on something. Timbers took a big swing on Evander. I believe a $10 million fee on this one for Midtjylland. A 24-year-old Brazilian number 10. It is among the 10 most expensive incoming transfers in MLS history, so that's a big deal. I can't say that other than sort of reading all the stats about Evander leading Europa League and assists, et cetera, Dave, that I know a ton about this, other than Timbers exec said, hey, we wanted to send a message that we were taking big swings, that we were trying to improve this group as much as possible. Seems like this is very clearly the end of the Sebastian Blanco as the main man era, if that hadn't already ended about a year ago. You watched 24 minutes of highlights on YouTube, I assume, backed by like some good, you know.
I didn't realize. I thought that was private for the meeting. I'm disappointed that that's not being put out there in the real meeting. No, I did.
It must have been good. 24 minutes, that's like a Netflix show.
So, Kalen, what really
did you
kept
watch
me
it all,
going,
or did you have your phone out too?
No, I was locked in. What really kept me going throughout the whole time was just to see if he would ever touch the ball with his left foot. and he never did. Not a single time. Not a first touch. Not a cutback. Nothing.
Everything. Is there another 24 minute that you missed? Is there
maybe a maybe it's an A B side type thing, and I just didn't know about the left foot reel. But I think we said this when the rumors first came out. Talking to people around Scandinavian soccer, they say when he's on, he's better than Hani Mukhtar. The question with Hani when he came to MLS was how often he would be on. That's the same question for Portland. Is that sort of was the limitation? It sounds like from keeping him going into a bigger space in Europe. But this is an ambitious move, and this is a club that just you tuned in over the last year, and it was like, is there enough stuff to groan and just fall over the line? It wasn't a club that felt like there was a ton of vision of what makes them great. It was, is Luis Mabiala and Sebastian Blanco and Diego Chara experienced enough and veteran enough just to make the margins work? And now this is the reset to the future of the club. And now you look at him and Jimmy and Paredes and Ayala and all those pieces, and there starts to be that next step going forward. Don't say Eric Williams.
I was going
to. Yeah, don't say it because it's not a part of it.
Maybe they say it will be. These things have a way of being ironed out, maybe.
What'd you just say about the allocation from Ismael Kone? Where is that going?
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point on that one. So with big news for them there. Other big news. So Inter Miami had their moment in the in infamy, I should say. And the Galaxy have had theirs. It sort of snuck under the radar here and happened at a time where we weren't talking much about the league and the World Cup was distracting us. But MLS announced sanctions against the LA Galaxy following an investigation surrounding the Christian Pavone deal when he was added to the roster as a TAM player in 2019. Basically, he should have been a DP.
Was this 2011 and 2012? No.
Okay. You're trying to relitigate history there, sorry, huh?
You think Mickey Vardanen was really a DP? Is that what you're saying?
I'm like, Mike Mickey is too good to just he was too good.
How'd you fit all these guys, huh?
He was just scoring too many goals in the playoffs. Sorry. I'm bitter.
Chris Klein suspended. That's how everyone felt May.
About Adam Moffitt on the other side, Caleb.
That's right. Shout out to Moff.
I'm willing to go further down this rabbit hole if you guys want to.
No, I think we're good.
I don't think anybody accused the Houston Dynamo of overspending during that time. we got it done though.
Chris Klein suspended through May of 2023. There's a loss of $1 million in GAM, which was recouped. We'll talk about that Kevin Cabral trade in just a second. And then a $1 million fine for the club. Greg Vanney is going to serve as the interim sporting director. And then also of note on these sanctions, secondary transfer window. That's the summer window of this year. The Galaxy will not be allowed to add a player from abroad. So I guess that means they could do it within MLS, but they couldn't go out and sign.
Yeah, weird that got pushed back to the secondary transfer window. I wonder why they didn't do that for the primary transfer window.
I guess, look, long window. We'll find out about these things.
Did Greg Vanney, did he run the sporting side? Has he done that before?
No.
No, okay. But I think he would have wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, you would feel secure about that piece of it, at least.
Yes. That part is probably a good thing for the Galaxy. Ricky Pooge was signed last summer. So, it was Gaston Brugman and Martin Caceres. All those guys were big pieces of the Galaxy making the playoffs and playing a super exciting game, ultimately unsuccessfully against LAFC. And they're on the roster now. So, nothing can happen there.
Is Caceres?
Don't know. Maybe.
Already had contracts.
Yeah. It'd be cool if he did, but, they're in for Aaron Long, perhaps, et cetera, et cetera. Any thoughts here on the Galaxy, let's say, bending/breaking, obviously, the rules and getting caught and punished?
Can we just run the This Is Soccer Heritage clip from Mourinho? Do you have that on standby, Anders?
No, I think we just have the Frank De Boer stuff.
Yeah, we just have the Frank De Boer one, which,
taken astray for no reason in a Galaxy.
We could run that one if we really wanted.
I read something, some quote from the worst manager in the history of the Premier League, Frank De Boer.
Okay, so I think we'll just look. They broke the rules. They broke the rules. They're being punished. That's
he really just have that on deck.
We often listen to that one in times of less urgency. I don't think there's anything other to say other than they got caught and now they're paying the price. We'll see how much that affects them going forward. They did reacquire the GAM. Kevin Cabral sent to the Colorado Rapids for $1 million in GAM. Conveniently, I think the price might have been set. The price was set. The Galaxy are going to cover 50% of salary for the next three seasons, and Cabral will still be a DP with the Rapids. Obviously, he's was a very expensive player at the start of 2021, $6 million, 23-year-old now. He had 6 goals, 5 assists, and 61 appearances, and we talked often about maybe his struggles in the final third.
He is statistically the worst finisher, right, in Major League Soccer, and at a really
high volume. I believe
his
difference between expected goals plus expected assists and actual output, I think, is, if it's not the worst, it's somewhere in that range. The Galaxy, by the way, open a DP spot.
And this, listen, Colorado fans, I saw reacting. They're like, well, how am I supposed to feel about this? This is where Colorado sits right now. So the move makes sense for them. It's a flyer where someone else paid the transfer fee and is paying half the salary for a piece that, if he plays okay and recoups some of his value, you sell for a higher number than what you acquired him for.
And so you're saying this is just for it to have the value to sell, to like basically like an asset play? Well, are you saying this is a good move for them on the pitch?
Listen, if he's good, it's good for them. And for him to recoup the value, he has to play well for them. Right. Is this the one piece Colorado needs to win MLS Cup? No, they're more pieces away than that. But I can understand the idea that he could have a positive impact on you in a soccer way coming back. Cole Bassett's coming back to the team this year as well. They obviously lost from Kellen to Mark Anthony Kay. Those pieces, Austin Trusty, now Estevez isn't back. Sam Vines already left. Yep. So there's a lot of movement in this Colorado team. The move, and in the light of all that, Kalen, the move makes sense, but this is not Pozuelo from Toronto, right, where you turn around and you're a contender because he comes into your team.
The right. Jonathan Lewis on one wing and Kevin Cabral on the other experience is going to chef's kiss.
It's going to be
chef's kiss.
If you want a souvenir, it's going to be very expensive to get tickets behind the goal.
Don't do Jonathan Lewis like that.
Dang.
I think this is a very savvy move by the Rapids. You know, I'm shocked, honestly, in some ways that it wasn't like Montreal with all their Gambian. Like, yeah, why not? We'll take that shot. We'll resell them down the line. Look, they weren't going to fill their – they aren't filling their DP spots. So the idea that using a DP spot on Kevin Cabral is some huge sacrifice for the Rapids just doesn't jive with reality. Now, there's sort of word that they might be filling more of those this year, but I will wait and see on any and all DP expenditure for the Colorado Rapids. He could be really good. He gets in great positions, Doyle. He makes you want to tear your hair out when he gets there. But like, look, Robin Fraser will have spoken to Greg Vanney at length about Kevin Cabral.
Yeah.
It's not like this is like, oh man, mystery. Who's this guy and his training habits and who he is as a player? Like, what went wrong in LA? Like, Robin Fraser will know all those things. And now it's about, you know, getting more out of him than somebody else could get. We saw with Diego Rubio this year. How much more did the Rapids get out of Diego Rubio than Sporting Kansas City?
Well, three years now.
Yeah.
Right?
Ever got out of him, et cetera. But yeah, this year was like his big, you know, sort of like big jump. So yeah, this is what you got to do. If you're the Rapids, you take a shot. There's significant upside. It could be in a market down the line. You hope it's on the field for you, and you're paying 50% of the salary, and it's GAM that you probably got off a player sale, and you weren't going to pack your roster with GAM required players either. So yeah, it works for both teams.
I don't know if it's what you had to do.
Yeah, you don't have to do it. That's fair.
But I do think it is an interesting wrinkle as far as a profile or way that clubs might not have to go, who aren't going to go out to the market, international market, as much, can approach things. Because we've seen Colorado have success basically finding players that they felt were undervalued at Trust other you. Clubs. Yeah, and bringing into their system and finding success out of that. Less so last year. Down year, of course, than the year before. But I do think the idea of saying, okay, well, I'm going to actually, you've taken this risk. And one thing, he played a ton. I mean, Vanney played him all the time. I mean, part of those, why those numbers are so high is he just continued to play them. So the value of the threat is, I think, what was a part of this decision as well, of like for Colorado, as far as saying this guy is threatening, like we need to create opportunities. We need to create goals. Cause at times they struggled with that. And then if you look at the price where it's like, you know, that 50% off the salary, then you're saying, okay, well, this is a little, you almost have to like recalibrate your picture of the player versus the way we've discussed him to this point. So I think it's interesting to see if more teams might do that. Is there any precedent for success for this? Have we seen other clubs go out and find
Julian Carranza?
Okay. Yeah.
Julian Carranza would be an example.
Different though. It's different, right? Like Carranza barely played 2 years in Miami. And you know, you could say, all right, well, it's because he was bad. Like, fair enough.
It was because he was bad.
Miami was bad.
100%. I don't disagree with that.
We've read the stats, man. We've seen 61 games of Kevin Cabral in Major League Soccer. He's also what, 3 years older than Carranza was?
He's older,
when,
yeah.
When Carranza was traded. I get why you take the risk if you're Colorado here, because players who get into good spots to score and assist tend to eventually figure out how to actually score and or assist.
They have Mikey Barrios on their team. They're right. Experienced with this.
But
and also, a part of it seems like
Barrios also has a season where he scores 9 or 10 goals and then scores 1 or 2. You know, you never know what you're going to get with him.
But Doyle, you pointed out his like lack of confidence too, right? Like that
he seemed emotionally broken at times.
By the end of this past season, he wasn't even actually generating expected goals because he had stopped making those runs in the box that would get him ostensibly tap-ins. Like first half of the season, I'm a bad person. I made a highlight reel of all of Kevin Cabral's incredible misses. And he had one against LAFC, I think it was, where he was 4 yards out. Absolutely brilliant run. Perfect ball to him for a near post finish, and he somehow managed to kick the ball backwards. It was absolutely – by the second half of the season, he was no longer in those spots. Like, you could see him on, you know, the side of the six, and, like, he's got the inside position. He is going to make that near post – like, if he's on the near post, he's going to get a chance at a one-time finish, and he just stands there at the side of the six because he doesn't want – to have another spectacular miss. So anyway, I get why Colorado did it. He does a lot of the things that good soccer players tend to do. I picked him for the David Goss theorem winner in 2022, or predicted him because of that. Obviously, he did not live up to it. But we have seen worse players eventually become good players in MLS with the right situation, with the right coach. And the hope for Colorado is that's what he becomes. I care less about that because I think it's unlikely. I'm really interested to see what this Galaxy team, who I think is one piece away from being like 65 points, shield contenders, maybe, you know, among the MLS Cup favorites. I'm really more interested in seeing what they do with their now open DP slot, though. Bear in mind, because they've used all of their U22 signings, they have to, if they're going to address this, they're either going to have to sign a young DP or they'll have to sign a DP who hits under the max TAM threshold.
Can I just, because sorry, I don't remember. Are there any center backs on this team?
There's one, Caceres for
that's the improvement, right? Seriously.
Well, Aaron Long might sign Aaron Long, right?
They've gotten rid of Derek Williams. I think we're all where we're at on Nick DePue. I'm probably the highest of all of you. And Sega Koulibaly is still there?
Yes. Okay. Correct.
Cool.
Yep. I did enjoy Galaxy fans just dunking on the Rapids. And it's like, but you guys are paying 50% salary and you paid $6 million for the dude 2 years ago.
I have to digress. And I have to do the most awful thing. One of my group chats, they just DM'd me to let me know that Matt Turner has now unliked the Geo Instagram post.
Whoa. When you're unliking, you're walking the like back.
Kalen, I'm destroying you on your own. Like, you got the 10,000 yard stare,
this is
man.
Officially not your beat anymore, Kalen. You're going to have to earn this one back. Okay, let's keep it rolling.
Time to pivot to TikTok, man.
Tom Bogert is just absolutely killing the MLS offseason. If you want to know what's happening, you should probably go follow Tom Bogert. He says, Jesse Zardes, in case Jesse wasn't a one-name reference for you, if you're listening to this show, it damn well better be. Jesse to Austin FC in free agency. Seems like a good move. Reunites with Josh Wolf. They need a center forward. He will make the runs, the system he's been in before and thrived in. So Jesse to Austin FC, very interesting there. Doesn't seem like they could sign him to a DP deal, and I don't know that you wouldn't also do that. He's been on max TAM. He is out of contract. you would think that he's going there to try to get things going again and maybe compete for a trophy, because that's where Austin is right now. Matt Hedges has options. Toronto, San Jose, and Cincinnati have made offers. Dave, SKC and Houston have interest. If you were Matt Hedges, where would you go?
Toronto.
Really?
Yeah, I would always choose to live in Toronto. One.
Okay.
So that's Canada done. Two, it sounds like the most fun of all of them. And he could be the Drew Moore guy, and they could win MLS Cup, and he could be that guy. I mean, if he goes to SKC, what's he going to do? Play next to Fontas?
They did resign Fontas.
So now he's the guy who has to clean up for Fontas's mess? If you're cleaning up for someone's mess, you might as well do it in Toronto.
What are the other ones? Cincinnati?
Cincy and San Jose. I would go to Cincy if I was him.
Yeah.
Because I think they're going to play that three-man back line. It seems like a perfect way, like Drew Moore style, to extend your career. And he wants a third year. So you play in the back line with Miazga and like Haglund or Murphy or whoever on the other side of you.
Cheaper cost of living, too. So yeah, last contract goes a lot farther.
He's going to have a McMansion. For sure. I would go to Cincinnati. Aaron Long, Kalen. Galaxy, Rapids, and maybe Miami or Seattle. Where would you go if you're Aaron Long?
I would say Galaxy. Galaxy probably makes the most sense. I could see Seattle, too. I could see that as another option as far as being able to – I don't know. For some of these veteran guys in free agency who have been around a while, and I would say the money is always going to be number one. But I do think that being a part of a winner and being in a club that's like high profile is always going to have some draw. And so I could see him being, you know, there's the Galaxy. If you solve that, you're back towards like the way Omar Gonzalez would. I mean, that's a tall task. He's got a big stature there, but as far as having that sort of centerpiece that can get them back to winning a championship, that would be really compelling. If I was Long, and then I think Seattle is always going to be up fighting for it. And he has some history. I think he was cut by them back in the day when he was, I think coming through the USL. And it seems like he'd be a good fit there as well. So I could see either of those situations being appealing to him.
Yeah. You go to Miami and you say, "Hey, Chris, are you guys signing Lionel?" Because I mean, if you are, I might be quite interested. We'll see what happens there in Long. He is obviously in demand. Other free agents still available: Alexander Collins, Sean Johnson, a couple NYCFC guys. Haven't heard any peeps on that. Jonathan Osorio, nothing there, but you'd expect he'd be looking at European options as well as potentially staying in MLS. Jackson Mendez, we've said we don't think he'll be back, but I don't know. Maybe somebody makes him a good offer. And Ronald Matarita, I guess, out there still as well. Here's a DP that's close to signing, or maybe has. Tom says, Charlotte FC have reached a verbal agreement with Rossing for Enzo Copetti, who's 26, had 11 goals, 4 assists, and 25 league appearances in the Argentine League. Fee would be around $6 million. What do you think, guys? Charlotte?
So everything I've seen about this is he's like a gigantic, bruising center forward who covers a ton of ground. Has had ACL surgery, I think, last season. So there's obviously the worry there. It feels, though, like a move that he could play with Swiderski, or he could be there because you're going to sell Swiderski. So it feels like it makes sense in terms of the roster building and a piece that would elevate you, because clearly they were better when Daniel Rios was on the field. If he's in a similar profile but a higher level player, then that's sort of what you're looking for. I would say I don't think you can have a ton of confidence in Charlotte's front office to be able to make these moves based off what you saw over the last year, but they got better. Your hope is that the process has improved and this is the right guy to make the move. There seems to be a lot of clubs that were interested, and this is sort of an interesting signing.
Zenit was one of the clubs reported to be interested in him. I think it was 19 goals over his last 40 appearances with Rossing, but before that, he didn't have 19 goals based on what I've seen and researched it to his name. Now, injury might have been a part of that. There's a big question here. The question is who Enzo Copetti has been over the last 2 years, 18 months or so, is that who he is truly? That's the player that they're going to get. He's going to come in. He's going to be a 15-goal scorer in MLS, et cetera. Or is he a late bloomer? Or is this sort of a flash in his career and he's not going to be able to keep this production going? And if you're paying $6 million for a player and he's a 26-year-old attacking player out of Argentina, you probably should expect that he needs to be a true game changer in MLS. I mean, I think back, Sebastian Driussi was signed at 24 from Zenit for $1.5 million more and is obviously an MVP candidate. I'm not sure that you would look at Enzo Copetti and be like, that guy's going to be an MVP candidate. It seems to me more like a best case scenario Gustavo Bo situation, which could be really good. I mean, like at his best, Gustavo Bo was absolutely wonderful in this league.
If they had a player of that quality in that position, they would have easily made the playoffs this year, right? Isn't that the next step for them?
Yeah. And then you get more out of the the DP from Poland they signed as well. And look, Swiderski has been good. So, yeah, it's a wait and see. By the way, Jordi Alcevar sold the Independiente de Valle, so that experiment ended quite quickly for them. Here's one you like, Dave. Andres Pereira traded to the Union. 750K GAM and then 100K in incentives and sell-on percentage. 22-year-old, Colombian-American, and one-time U.S. international. But a ton of career ahead of him, and really seems like he fits into a lot of the positions in that diamond midfield where they need cover slash a little bit of help.
Yeah, the total number I think is probably a little higher than I would have expected, but it sounds like there was, one, a bidding war, and or other people were interested, and two, you know Philly's flush with allocation money, so they're at this point they're going to have a hard time winning those deals by the 50 or 100,000, but for them it won't matter. They were one of the thinnest rosters in Major League Soccer last year. It's one of the things we never really had to talk about outside of Bedoya's injury, but the two center backs started every single game. They had a little bit of depth at fullback, and Leon Flock is very flexible, and so they've moved him around. They've sold Paxton Aronson, who was one of the only pieces they were bringing in off the bench in midfield and is obviously a different type of player. So I look at this signing, and you can change the way you play if you need to. He can fill in for Martinez. You can move Flock around if you have to. And I think this is a piece that he fits better in Philly than he does in Orlando. So fitting into their system feels like it's going to be successful for him. And now you've covered in case you do want to sell someone, you've covered in case of injuries, especially after the year they had last year, the amount of games they played and going into CCL this year.
And Leagues Cup.
And Leagues Cup, adding even more to that. I mean, their number that we've seen floating around is they think they're going to play 50 games this year.
Yeah.
At a minimum. So it just, you need more bodies. You need bodies that can be successful. It feels like he's part of that. And eventually this could be a move where he's either a staple for a while you're moving other pieces, or you can move him on if he's good enough.
He got the siren treatment on extra time, and I don't know what that portends for him, but that is certainly an omen of sorts. I think it's a good move for the Union. Thoughts on DC United offseason so far, Doyle? Aaron hit me up and asked about that. He also hit me up and said that he had a dream that he called me on my day off to give me all his random MLS takes, and that I was very upset with him, and he should know that I would never be upset about such things. Let's see. We have a bunch of guys leaving. We have Klich from Leeds United as a possible attacking midfielder, 32-year-old, been a big part of, you know, being promoted to Premier League and staying there. And then an Iraqi national team left back who spent his entire life and career in Sweden coming in. Any thoughts on DC's offseason so far, Doyle?
They're going to be older. It looks like they're going for a quick fix with the, you know, adding veterans basically all over the field at this point, which is understandable given that Wayne Rooney's probably not going to be there forever. And we've seen teams that go for a quick fix. We've seen it hit before. If they can keep these guys healthy, now DC's not going to play 50 games. So they don't have, you know, they're not going to ask as much of them, but like, they're going to have to rotate the squad. They're still going to have to get stuff out of the academy kids who are either already on the roster or are coming through the roster. And like, those are Wayne Rooney's two mandates is, you know, win on one hand and develop players on the other. They're going to be a fascinating team to watch this year because like, between what they've added and what their ambition is, you can say, oh yeah, I could see if Benteke scores 25 goals and the midfield really works, like this could be a 60-point team. And you could also say, yeah, these guys are going to melt in the heat and they're going to have 32 points and a high draft pick once again. Like, anything feels like it's in play between those two outcomes for DC United.
All right, I'm going to rapid fire us through some transfer news. Chime in. This is all via Tom Bogert, who, again, is just killing this. Let me know if you have anything to say. Red Bull's finalized deal to sign Elias Manoel from Grêmio for $1 million to keep us on the Brazilian pipeline. The Dynamo signed Brazilian center back Michael from Atlético Mineiro for $500K. He was on loan with Dynamo 2, where he made 17 next pro appearances. He also got an MLS once, 22-year-old. FC Dallas set to sign Brazilian right back Giovanni Jesus, 21, from Cruzeiro for $1 million.
Is this not one of those? And there's a reference here that I don't know, but the inability to find right backs for FC Dallas, like they've produced them. They have had so many strikeouts at this position. It's just, and $1 million, a lot, right? Nanu played in AFCON and Champions League over the last 2 years, and that was the option they went with last year. So I would like to put my hand up and say to FC Dallas, if you need someone at right back, talk to Kalen Carr.
Dave, I thought you were going to put yourself forward. I will not be tracking back.
You wouldn't be worse than
FC Dallas have signed Sebastian Ibiaga in free agency.
I like that one. Especially if you lose Hedges and you see a guy who stepped in big matches, MLS Cup, played really well, will be, I'm hopefully set for a pay increase, I would imagine, with this move, but it's still going to come at a lower price and someone you can bank on to start. He's done it at NYCFC, he's done it at LAFC. Each team has been a part of winning teams and continue to make the group better. So, I think this is a really smart pickup.
Their hope is that Quiñones or mainly Nkosi Tafari takes the step. I think Tafari took a half step back last year, which is unfortunate. So that's where Ibiaga makes sense of you don't want him to start 30 games for you, but if he has to start 13 to 15 while you're figuring that piece out and he can help other guys get there.
We have an update on the likes of the Gio Reyna Instagram post here. Joe Scally, George Bello, P-Fock, Mark McKenzie, Ricardo Pepe, Tim Ream as well. This shows Matt Turner, but I believe Turner has backed his, I'm trusting your Instagram reporting, Doyle, that Turner has backed his like out, but we will go ahead and check that at a later date and confirm on all that. This is all reportedly.
This is all like the highest level of journalism right now.
Oh boy. Okay. Minnesota United signs Clint Irwin, Zarek Valentin, and Daniel Henry in free agency. The Whitecaps are interested in free agent Uruguayan center back. He's at Nacional right now. He's 23. Matias Laborda. Been playing a decent amount, so that could be a signing. Sporting Kansas City re-signs Roger, Zusi, and Fontas.
Will I find a Joel Wiebe like on that Instagram post?
Probably not. I had to predict Joel's opinion on that one. Gio Moutinho signs for Spezia in Serie A. He leaves Orlando City. NYCFC's Nicolas Acevedo is reportedly going on loan to Bahia in Brazil, and Bryce Duke is training with Atletico Madrid while Reed Baker Whiting is with Freiburg.
And love to see Bryce get out there, just get some Bryce experience.
Love it. Andy from Revs Nation, does Bobby Wood to the Revs move the needle at all? Presumably third on the striker depth chart, but is there any chance we see him contribute in 2023? I'm as big a Bobby.
I was about to say they're barking up the right tree on this one.
As big a Bobby Wood guy as there maybe exists in the world. I'm rooting for Bobby. I'm rooting for him. But I'm not expecting
more
anything.
Goals in MLS this year.
Bobby
Wood
or Josie
or Pato?
Oh, I thought you were going to go Josie.
No.
You
went for wait a minute. We went for I have some Instagram reporting on Josie.
Yeah.
From the folks at the Bent Musket, they say he followed Vasco da Gama and Vasco's head coach on Instagram.
Wow.
Which is what he
smoking
did this year
ahead of
before his loan to.
But they also say that Vasco's coach was asked about it and he said, yes, we just exchanged pleasantries. He wished me the best of luck. There was no talk of a move.
Mm. God, Instagram reporting is spreading like wild.
There's a chance that Pato and Josie team up on Vasco, and now you're a Brazilian Serie A superfan.
Dude, the interchange between MLS and Brazil's Serie A is, I mean, this is the next frontier. It's incredible. I'm rooting for Bobby, I will say that, but I would say to expect anything is is probably not the right word move.
Yeah, let's see what he can do if it worked out.
Yeah, it could work out. He's probably an off the bench guy for them, obviously, and they need their DP striker they signed last year, Veroni, to be a DP striker. Okay. How about this one? We'll end with a couple here. McNutty hit us up and said, did the Houston Dynamo win the World Cup? It feels that way since the World Cup distracted us from the Ben Olsen hire and they should have got more criticism.
Jeez.
That was just a rugged tweet that had to, we'll just let that one silently marinate. Andrew and KC wants to know how Kalen enjoyed his Palm Springs MLS Next adventure. Give us the cliff notes there.
I didn't talk to you about this one already.
No, not publicly at least.
Okay. No, I was texting you guys about it. It was awesome. I actually hadn't been, all due respect to Mr. Goss, who has been laying the groundwork in Frisco. Frisco for me, not really.
I was going to say, I don't respect a single person who went to this and was like, I really enjoy going to these like youth tournaments and like seeing the next generation. Yeah, in Palm Springs.
Yeah,
okay.
Coachella. Yeah,
it was everyone amazing. Will go to the Hawaii Invitational and that's it.
No, I saw a ton of talent. I thought the tournament was like top notch. I couldn't help but think that I wish I had access to playing against the best talent in the country at that age and being exposed to that. The atmosphere was actually really fun. Like, I don't know if it's just this young I'm going to just get sound totally washed, but just like the way that they were celebrating, they run straight to the cameras afterwards. it was incredible. So I saw some really good teams. I saw some teams that stood out, like the Philadelphia Union Academy, as would surprise nobody. FC Dallas saw some ballers on the U17 team. San Jose, really liked San Jose. It made me think, I saw like some guys that I'd heard about for a while. Like we've all talked about or heard about Cruz Medina. I saw him up close.
I had him on my 2026 U.S. World Cup projected roster.
Did you really? Wow.
Yeah. He'll be 19. He'll be like 6 months younger at that cycle than Reyna and Musa and Scally were for this cycle. He's the one kid that I was willing to take a flyer on and do a little bit of wish casting and get him, you know, project out like, yeah, if he hits, he could be that level. And so Kalen, after watching him in one game,
2026, book it. It's over, you know, just, I don't even know if he has.
Would
to
you put
a
guarantee on that? Would you, are you willing to go guarantee?
No, absolutely not. But I was impressed. He looked very good. He looked super comfortable on the ball, all the things that you hear about him, and seemed like a step above. I do sort of think this is a really important point where you move from basically being the best player in certain circumstances to moving into first team and not being the best very quickly. But I would expect to see him potentially get some time, maybe towards the middle part of the season, back half. I think it's going to take a little bit with the changes happening at San Jose. I wouldn't say I would, even if at his age, even if it was next year, the year after, or it'd probably need to be next year, but I'm excited to see what Lucci does. Cause it wasn't just him. There was some other good talent available in that academy. So it was really cool. It was really cool to see. And then the other part of it too, was just like, I saw a ton of former teammates and friends. Justin Mapp was there scouting, Tyson Wall with Austin FC, just a lot of different, friends. Kai Kamara, there was a MLS player engagement group was looking at doing some, there was coaching licenses, there was some like post-career development stuff for guys who are recently retired. So it was really, really cool to kind of just be a part of that and see it all take place at once. But yeah, I was like very impressed by the level. It was tactically, technically better than I expected even, and I expected a lot. So it was fun.
Just to continue and end our Instagram reporting, Jude Bellingham is in the comments here. I don't know him for real, him FR Hart. Things are going down. So you go check it out. All right. We'll end here. Jordan from Minneapolis. Weeby, I wanted to share this with the group, but you are the resident father. Yes, sir. This is mostly for you. My daughter Coretta was born yesterday during the U.S. Iran game. My wife and I have been cheering on the U.S. through this World Cup cycle, and I've been anxiously awaiting the arrival of both the tournament and our child. Yesterday, we were so locked in for the birth of our daughter that we had no idea what was happening in the game. A few hours after delivery, we looked up the scoreline and found the highlight of Pulisic's goal. I said, wow, he really put his body on the line for the team. My wife responded, I put my body on the line for the team. Amen. Amen. I will say that I watched MLS's back in the delivery room when Wyatt was born, not during birth, but afterwards. So you can fudge that a little bit if you need to. And I guess that's all we got. All right.
I was going to throw out, by the way, official for the semifinals just came out. Catherine Nesbitt will be an offside VAR.
Oh, hell yeah.
Drew Fisher will be the VAR in the France-Morocco game. And Armando Villarreal will be his backup.
So no Ismail Elfath?
No, not believe, on any of the staffs.
I believe this. Elfath then would, I don't think he's been sent home. I think he's one That's of eight referees still in Qatar. I believe he would have an opportunity to ref the final potentially.
Yes.
So that would be absolutely incredible.
I love it. I love Ishmael. Yes. He's the best, just as a guy and a fantastic referee. So yep. I one of my favorite moments in the World Cup is when he tapped up the player and had to get a red card afterwards.
Abubakar.
Yeah. So congratulations to Catherine, and we're hoping for good news for Ismail Elfath. All right, that's it for us. We'll see you on Thursday, everybody. Adios.